It's time for real stories from those who make our region and our country their home. Time for making yourself at home, thanks to the support from the Ethnic Communities Development Fund.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Making Yourself at Home. We are here on Access Radio Taranaki 104.4 FM, your voice, your choice. Today in the studio, we have Brian from the US, Alina from Romania, and myself, Clara, from Spain, as co-host. And we are welcoming our special guest, Natalia. Natalia is originally from Russia. She grew up near Washington, D.C., and then studied and worked in Melbourne, eventually moving back to the U.S. before finally settling here in Taranaki with her husband and her two children. Welcome, Natalia. We are looking forward to hear your journey and how you ended up here in Taranaki after all those travels.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Yeah,
good
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Yes, and just to add on that, I met Natalia a few years ago, I think, when you just arrived in New Plymouth. And Natalia was so refreshing, and I really enjoyed spending time with her, the migrant women meetup at the library. So this is, I think, where we've met.
Yeah.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit more about you. How did you end up in New Plymouth from all the places in the world?
Oh, I can thank my very, very handsome and convincing husband for moving here. I met him through rugby. We had a rugby connection. I played about a year of university level rugby when I went to my undergrad university, and then got injured, left the team, didn't think much more of it until I was invited back into a social gathering and met players who were there playing for the Washington, D.C. team, and met my husband, made friends with him. We eventually dated, moved countries, got married, had kids. And he had always sort of entertained the idea of coming back and living here. And we visited here quite a few times, got married here. And it was always an idea that was in the far future until 2020 came around. And I had stopped working, the kids' schools were closed, and we thought, okay, if there's ever a window for us to get everything together, get the visas together, organize the paperwork, move our entire life overseas and give it a go, it's now. And we did. And so we came over in February 2021. We did the hotel quarantine for 2 weeks. And right out of there, we came to Waitara to stay with my mother-in-law until we found our own place. And we went from wearing masks, quarantining, not seeing anyone for a year, to it was my son's sixth birthday party where my lovely mother-in-law invited all her friends, all the cousins, and it was a big group in her backyard, and that was our welcome to New Zealand. Just haven't really looked back since. We've moved a few times while living here. Moved from Waitara to Bell Block, and now we're in Highlands Park. My husband's gotten settled in more or less with finding new work, which took a little while for him to get settled. He's gone back to his old rugby club. He's now coaching and playing, and it took me a while. I was a physical therapist or physiotherapist here to transfer my registration. And once I did, I started working. And once I started working, I stopped seeing you, Alina.
Yes, I think so, yeah. Because I was also not coming anymore to the migrant meetups.
Because it's in the morning on a weekday.
Yes, yeah, on a Tuesday. Yeah. But it was like the highlight of my week before I was working full time. And when we started, do you remember we were wearing masks?
So I didn't know what anyone looked like.
I just saw everyone's eyes. And and then once I came to a meeting and the masks were off and I was like, hello, people.
Wow.
Like,
yeah, it was amazing, right? Yes. Yeah.
I can put your mouth and lips to your face and your voice.
Yeah.
But it was such a welcoming group. And I just loved how Stephanie ran it. And here she was, like, giving you time to talk about whatever you wanted to talk about and make you feel so welcome. And from there, I found volunteer opportunities. And I just remember having, like, a full schedule. And everyone's like, how do you know all these people? And how do you know about all these activities? And it all came from the group.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm just reminiscing about that because we had a meetup yesterday and we had one a few weeks ago as well.
Yeah. I think it's a great group that is delivered in the for the migrants at the library. So whoever wants is new in town. We are meeting each Tuesday at 11 a.m. at the library. And I know Stephanie was the one who was running it. And now it's Amanda. So she's also lovely. So, yeah, for all the women who are migrants. And unfortunately, there is no men.
I was just wondering if I could show up.
Yeah, maybe you should, Brian, right?
Yeah, you can create one.
It's quite...
Okay. But from memory, we did have husbands come and family members and kids. My kids, I know, remember quite a few lunches and library meetings. So I think we should... We should change it.
Open we should definitely.
Yeah, we should offer that.
That'd be nice.
Great.
New to New Plymouth. Yeah. Just doesn't have to be male or female. And I love that it was also other Kiwis from different parts of New Zealand that came too. And they didn't necessarily have to be an immigrant from a different country. But it was great to see their take and comparison of Christchurch to New Plymouth or Auckland to New Plymouth
and exactly
what they thought was different.
That makes sense because even if they are Kiwis, perhaps they don't know anyone in Taranaki.
Yeah.
They are from a different part of the country.
And it can be, New Plymouth doesn't have a welcoming committee when you move here. You don't step off the plane and people go, hey, welcome, let me show you around. So it's good to have a group like that.
So you started to create your tribe through this migrant connection event that happens on Tuesday and volunteering opportunities. And what other things helped you to start to meet new people here?
I was quite lucky, and I think I was here for some time before I joined the group because I had a built-in support system with my husband's family. Mm. So his mom, Gail, lives in Waitara. She knows almost everybody in Taranaki. She was a postie for 30 years. My sister-in-law, Bridget, lives out in Uranui, and she was very, very involved with the community events there and at some point was running the community events out of their community center. I think she's been here on the radio show. So she's also a really well-known person in the community. My husband also went to school here and left when he was 21, I believe, to go play rugby overseas. But he was just, you know, the first year was running into old friends, and I was really lucky to kind of adopt his group of friends who are all really lovely and welcoming. Mm. And I think at some point I thought, okay, but I've got to meet some other expats, and that's what took me to the group. I guess before I had joined the group, I volunteered for as much as I could at the kids' schools. I took like every trip that I could go on with the kids. I went.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, I just was like, I'm gonna say yes to what I can and just see what sticks and what I enjoy. I think it's a little bit harder to, you know, if I was a person without kids, I would think, okay, I'm gonna follow my hobbies and pursue my hobbies. But your schedule with young kids kind of limits you from doing all those things, especially when you're the primary caretaker. So
yeah, it is.
Yeah. So yeah, so I couldn't, you know, I would love to go salsa dancing, but couldn't do that. So yeah, there we were on school field trips. I met quite a few parents when I volunteered to be a basketball coach for my son's team.
Oh, and, did you? This is nice.
Yeah, and then I was like, I had the group chat, and it was just a way to connect with other parents. And, you know, now we've been here almost 5 years, and I think our, like, connection still goes back to those early days. I found some, I think I just talked as much as I could to the teachers to get to know, like, their recommendations for things to do with kids.
And how did your kids, like, settle in New Zealand? Did they notice, like, a lot of difference from the U.S. compared to New Zealand?
He was a very observant, critical thinker, I think, at his early age. And he really pointed out the differences, especially moving here during COVID, about, you know, mask wearing versus not mask wearing. And so he was kind of like, okay, like, I don't know, Mom. I'm not sure I'm buying all of this. Like, how are we shaking hands here? But we weren't allowed to in the U.S. So he was just trying to make sense of the differences and the rules. I gave him choices of what schools he could go to, and we settled on Maryland's. It's a relatively small school. It doesn't have a zone. And I really thought that was a good fit for him because he would get to grow with the small cohort of students and get to know them well and feel like he really belongs somewhere. I think that's worked out really beautifully. And my daughter started out, she also went through a couple of different kindies, daycares, and once she finally settled in, she then went to primary school with that group. So we enrolled her in Catholic school, and she's been with the same group of friends also since we've been here.
Nice.
So I think I just, but
it's
it took,
amazing to have the same people all the time, like to find your tribe.
We were talking about this yesterday. Like once your kids, your daughter said, "Oh, I love my teacher," and I said, "That's like the best thing to hear as a parent. You can just go, okay. They're settled, now I can think about myself." And even though it took a couple of tries and a couple of different approaches, like the kids are happy and settled. Yeah. And you know, because they come home and they say, "Mom, I did so many things in school today, and this happened and this happened. I can't wait for this to happen." And you just know as a parent when they're when they're good and they're settled. And
it's amazing.
It doesn't look like our childhood, and the education system here is different.
It's quite different, right?
Like, yeah, very different from the Russian system, very different from the American system that I grew up in. But so it looks different, but you can tell when the kid is happy and thriving and they have goals, they have things to look forward to, they feel like they're challenged.
Yes.
Yeah. Here I was thinking I wouldn't have enough to talk about.
Yes, and now you have a lot of things. Yeah,
there's always many things to talk about.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind going back to the beginning and learning about, it sounds like you went to school in Russia, and then I'm interested to know what took your family from Russia to Washington, D.C., and if you can, I don't know, talk about some memories maybe about life in Russia.
As I'm getting older, I'm learning that there is my memory, my story of things, and then I'm also going back and reading about what was going on at that time period and comparing it to my experiences, so trying to educate myself a little bit more and kind of put the various experiences together. But I was born in Novosibirsk, which is in the middle of Siberia. Both parents are biochemists. That's what they trained in.
Nice.
And as far as I know, there's two big research institutes in Russia that do biochemical research, and I'm probably messing this up.
We don't know any of them, so it's all good.
It's all new knowledge for us.
I apologize. To my best understanding, in 1994, once the Soviet Union was collapsing, you were able to then leave the country, and you're able to apply for a green card. And I don't know all the details of how that went through, but my dad was able to get a green card, come over, and work as a postdoc at National Institute of Health.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then sometime later, we joined him, I think 4 months later. And it felt like forever. And then it was quite a few bumps and a little bit of turbulence in the getting over their part. And then we moved over.
So how old were you when you moved from Russia?
9 and a half.
9 and a half.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. And we moved over, settled outside of Washington, D.C., sort of in the neighborhoods where a lot of, international postdocs and other employees of National Institute of Health lived. Yeah. So so my life in Russia, as I remember it, was living in quite a small remote town that was designed for the employees of this research institute. So we were outside and quite far from the big city of Novosibirsk. We were in Akademgorod. No, we weren't in Akademgorod. We were in Koltsovo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's even a smaller town. I think I remember hearing that it was 10,000 people, and we were one of the first people to move there. So it was brand new when we moved there. A lot of research employees would live there. Quite safe. I had a lot of freedom. You know, I went to school, and then I just remember going playing with my friends, having a few after-school activities, and then rinse and repeat. It's quite a sort of very boisterous and free kid.
Nice.
I don't really remember much about, like, when did I have to go home? How did I know to go home? Just remember all my adventures and just having, like, the free layout of the town to go adventure and explore. And I had a little brother who's 2.5 years younger than me. And so living in Siberia, so we didn't have, it's not at the level where you have permafrost permanently on the ground, but you did have winter that starts, first snow is in September, and then from memory, it melts in May, finally.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's a long melting process.
So you have like minus degrees, or how? How cold can it be?
Yeah, the temperature.
I've read minus 50, but I don't. I have some memories of, you know, being completely fully clothed in fur and still feeling like the cold on my skin. But I think it's a very dry cold from what I remember it, as opposed to like the very moist and wet cold of Washington, D.C.
And you have very good heating inside the house, I imagine. Or maybe not.
I think it was good. I'm sure there was some difficulties, but that's hard to remember. But in the wintertime, it was a different, it was a different sort of schedule, because then you got to play as a kid. You got to go down big slides made out of ice. And
amazing.
We had those like ice sculptures and mazes that you could go run around in and spend a lot of time with friends running through those. And we had our sleds made out of cardboard. So just it was great as a kid.
Yeah. We had lots of opportunities to play.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We had the same in Romania. It was a lot of snow. And I also remembered, you know, walking through the tunnels of snow. It was amazing.
Yeah. So when was your winter?
So it was, I think it's same like in Russia, you know, so we had the same season like Russia, but the main winter starting December, January, February.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But December was quite cold, so all my Christmas were full of snow.
Yeah.
So Santa Claus was coming on a sled.
Yes. Oh my gosh, the sleds, those like Soviet sleds.
Yeah, we have the same.
We didn't have strollers. We just had the sleds, and you just tie your baby brother up and pull him around on the sled. Hope he stays warm. My mom said that for naps, babies would be put outside on the balconies to get the fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
which I love those stories. And I remember being quite, like, very close with my skis and taking the time to put the wax on depending on the temperature for the day.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Like, taking the skis to school and having lunchtime cross-country. We'd go on little cross-country skiing trips.
Amazing.
Wow. That sounds fun.
Yeah. But I think, too, like, so much time was spent in the winter, but a lot of my memories are from the summer. So I was like, I must have spent a lot of time sleeping. Yeah. And then just little memories of Soviet times, like the food vouchers and waiting in lines, going and using the Soviet medical system, and taking like lots of trains everywhere. Didn't have a car, took public transport, and on the weekends with the family going on the little plot of lands where you planted your sustenance that you then
corn
have to
and stuff, right?
Then you have to save and put it in the underground storage for the winter, the potato storage. So all those little memories. But I was quite protected and quite, you know, I just had quite a good experience, a good childhood there. And kind of when I talk to my husband and hear what his childhood was here, like, you know, feeling quite free in Waitara, and I think, it sounds very similar. Like, sounds like we had some similar experiences. And his family, his granddad had a farm, and his uncle lives on the farm. His cousin runs the dairy farm. So he had quite a bit of going over to the farm to spend weekends there. And
right, huh?
So when I met him, we had that common, like, I also spend time on farms, and
So it sounds like you might have went through quite the culture shock when you arrived in Washington, D.C., which I'm assuming around that time maybe wasn't the most safe country or city in the United States. So I guess the free-range childhood kind of ended there.
Yeah, free-range childhood ended there.
You wouldn't have your food vouchers and waiting in communist food lines.
No, we went crazy. Yeah. I just remember eating so much food when we moved over, and it was like the highlight of the week, going to the grocery stores and all looking at the variety of foods, and get home and bring back a box of a dozen donuts and taste every single one.
Wow.
I think that novelty went on for quite a few years. Also, we lived outside the city. It was a very multicultural neighborhood. I think every country, every nationality and culture was represented. So that probably made the settling in process a little bit easier, because, like, in my year, I was one of many students that started in ESOL, the English for Speakers of Other Languages. We had a big Spanish-speaking population in school, and you just didn't feel like you stood out, really. You're just, oh, yeah, okay, here's how you get started in this school.
Everybody's different, so nobody's different.
Yeah, my first teacher, I remember, was from Puerto Rico, and I had a couple of Russian-speaking classmates in my class as well, who would give me little tips and things to do to fit in. And so it wasn't as much of a shock as when I hear stories of people moving to, like, I don't know, a town with very little diversity. And far enough from Washington, D.C. downtown that I was protected from all the turbulence, but also there was quite a bit of a, you kind of knew where to stay away from and where, and I did have a lot of restrictions put on my freedom.
And you did uni around DC and got into rugby there?
I did. Okay. I put myself into the International Baccalaureate program and that gave me quite a few courses, college credits. So I was able to go in as a sophomore into University of Maryland, and I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, and University of Maryland is just down the highway, about 30 minutes drive. So I just felt like a continuation of my high school when I got there. Why did I join rugby? Mm-hmm. I think I wasn't competitive in any sports, but I wanted to be active and I wanted to be part of a team, and they were just really welcoming. I had a great coach, great teammates, and I thought it was just a really neat culture to be a part of, because we took bus trips to go play games at other universities. Coach Pam was just fantastic. We played on Frat Row, so it was a good reason to go out there a couple of times a week. And I loved everything about it.
There's definitely a counterculture, subculture with the rugby, university rugby scene in the States. I played a couple of seasons at North Carolina State. Did you ever make it to, I forget the name of the tournament weekend in Appalachians at Appalachian State? I think we played the Maryland men's team there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Did you ever make it to Boone, North Carolina?
Do you think we were at the same place at the same time?
Potentially. It's a special, Boone, North Carolina is a really neat little town in the mountains.
Possibly. Okay. It was a long bus ride with a lot of rugby songs.
Okay, yeah. Understandable.
And then memories of a motel, and then lots of rugby, and then the parties afterwards.
Yeah. Fuzzy memories, for sure.
Fuzzy memories. Yeah. But not because I was underage drinking.
Of course not.
It was interesting from meeting my husband's teammates later, and they would tell me that you can go to any town in the Midwest and join a rugby club. I didn't realize how prevalent it was in the States, and just how it's like it's a built-in community as well. I didn't feel the need to go back to playing. And now I do some physio and some strapping for my husband's team, and I enjoy being part of it, but I didn't feel the need to go, okay, like I need to be back on the field. I thought, no, I'll get into some Pilates.
Yeah.
But yeah, but the culture, I think, is very unique in the States.
Yeah.
And you get to be, I think it was club rugby when I started, and I saw they had moved up in rankings over the years. But you still got to be part of like a team at a university, which I really enjoyed.
Rugby really put New Zealand on the map for me. I remember, cool. A bunch of the guys that were on my team were big All Blacks fans, and up till then, I knew absolutely zero about New Zealand. I had heard of it, but that's just about as far as it went.
So what position did you play?
I was kind of a utility back. Just bounced around.
Same here.
Wow, amazing.
Inside center, out to the wing, and then fullback, and just, wherever. Yeah. I was quite a large back, but
did you guys have two tiers of teams?
Yeah.
Were you in the...
After a couple of games, I got moved up to the A tier. So
I was a solid B, but yeah. I remember it's good. You're looking back, we had enough people to put together two teams.
Mm.
I just held my solid place on the Bs.
Such a great talk about rugby, for our listeners, because I never knew anything about rugby. So it's nice to see the two of you chatting about it.
I think Kiwis assume, because I'm American, that I don't know rugby. They're quite surprised to hear that I have played rugby, particularly like in the States. I don't know if you experienced that also.
I think it's just been such a big part of my life, because once I met my husband, I was out on the field every weekend and everyone knew I was doing it. But it's just, this is the first time where we're living somewhere where he can be involved and I can be involved, and we're not like the only two people that we know that are you know, doing it. Like, like there's no other physios that I knew in the States that had worked with rugby players, but here I'm one of many.
Yeah. So oh, wow.
That's,
it's quite a niche, right?
Yeah. And do your kids play?
They do. My daughter started when she was two. My son.
When she was two.
When she was two. She was.
Nice.
She so is young. A great self-advocate, and she would want to do anything her brother did. So when they would say, oh, this sport is for and over, and she'd be like, "What? I can catch a ball," or golf, I think you have to be five. And she's like, look, I can swing the golf club. So whatever he signed up for, she signed up for as well. She's still going. She's still loving it. He's 10 now, so his games are getting, they have their positions. They're getting more competitive with each year. But it's great to see them, grow with the sports and have it be a big part of their life. And I didn't think because my husband stopped playing when he was 30, so I didn't think that they would actually see him get to play, but he's been playing quite a bit of game time this year.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing. And his team is in the playoffs, and they're going to the semifinals.
Oh, nice. And you can I ask you, because I know it's for me it was quite interesting to know about, because the parents are the coaches for the team, even though you don't have experience, you can be the coach. So, because I was asked if I can be the coach for my kids' teams, but I don't know anything. But I know one parent was joining and they didn't know anything about it. How is that for you? Is the same like in America, or it's different? How can you be a coach? You have to have some
you can
skills
learn
or
the
just
rules. Yeah, I've been in the company of some parent coaches that maybe switched sports and they were new to a sport that my kid was playing. But you get a rule book. You get quite a bit of support. Mm-hmm. I think everyone's happy for any parent that wants to be there to have a go. If you put your hand up, you can always be a co-coach. That's one thing I've learned. You don't have to do everything yourself. You can co-coach. You can co-manage. Mm-hmm. It makes life a lot easier to split up the responsibilities. I think what I love about being here is the give it a go mentality. If there's a if you want to do something, there's a way to do it. I was quite timid, I think, going back to doing athletic training or doing the strapping. And I remember I took a coach with this fantastic physio in town, Nick Arnold, and he was going over sports strapping, and I was my memory started jogging. I was like, hold on, I know all this. I've done this before when I lived in Australia with Aussie rules. Okay, I can actually come and apply this. And I just came and shadowed him for a few sessions and it's good for someone as timid as me to be able to have an opportunity in a space. And now I help out with my husband's team sometimes. So found a little niche. And I really do enjoy it, yeah.
Yes.
And that's a difference here compared to the States, because when they were doing semi-professional rugby in the States, it would be like fixing torn eyebrows with some, somebody.
Super glue.
Yeah.
Really.
There's super been worse.
I remember a lot of super glue and
materials.
Flying around.
Tampons. I'm not sure what was used to stitch up my husband's cheek, but it was anybody with any medical experience or even if it's not in medicine. But here it's taken, it's developed a lot more. There's courses you can take in supporting sports teams. There's different tiers of organization. As a parent, you can take sports courses. A great course I know that was for, I can give you more details if you want, but it's for young girls and teenage girls and learning about how to support them to keep them playing sports and learning more about their physiology and specifically how we can support them to stay in sports and not leave sports, and understanding the reasons behind their high dropout rates from sports. And it was started here in Taranaki, and
oh, really?
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah,
it is really cool. Yeah.
What's the program called? Do you know?
I will provide you resources after. That'd I'm blanking great. Out yeah. on the yeah, name right you. Now. Yeah. It was beta tested last year, and I believe she is going to. The woman behind it had worked with Olympic athletes, and so she's like using all her knowledge to develop this course, and she's gonna offer it as a product that you can sit and take and further your understanding.
Yeah, when you have the details to share, and we can put it in our social media, and then listeners can check it out.
Absolutely. And I really apologize for forgetting the name of it.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, don't worry. Yeah. And in your bio, you mentioned that you were also living in Australia for a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, so I applied for a postgrad program, and so it's a clinical doctorate at University of Melbourne. And what I really liked about that university and the program was, first of all, everyone had nothing but good things to say about Melbourne, and I really wanted to travel and get some more experiences under my belt. And so I thought this would be a great place to live in. And then once I got there, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so lucky. We're right next to this huge teaching hospital. There's a women's hospital, there's a children's hospital, and they're all, you know, relatively close to each other. They work really closely with the university, and there's a big sporting culture in Melbourne. Also, I found like quite a can-do attitude. Like, do you want to work with, VFL teams, which is like one level below AFL. If you want to go here, sign up, you're in, you're doing it. I know, like when I was getting ready to leave Melbourne University, they said, do you have any interest in like continuing on and doing a PhD program? And I said, really? This is the process for doing a PhD? You just have to be interested in doing it? And of course I was interested. I know you did a PhD program. And my husband was like, it's time for you to make some money.
So
I had been in school for I think 7 or 8 years at that time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So you have a PhD now, or
no?
Would you like to have one now, or is something that?
If you don't need it, you don't need it.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Unless you need it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, good one. Huh?
Typically, in my field, that's strictly needed for academia or strictly research positions. I would not recommend it for anybody who does not need to get a PhD to do a PhD.
How long it takes to do a PhD?
It depends whether you go through a master's program or not first. Mm. Fortunately, I received extremely good advice during my undergraduate, because I was interested in going into research at that time, was if you're going to be in the sciences, do not pay to get a postgrad degree. Figure out how to get paid to do it. And so sort of what led me to take some gap years between my undergraduate and my master's degree was just applying for various in the States they call them assistantships, to where you essentially get a salary, half year salary, you know, the equivalent of a half year salary, from the university, along with free tuition and all that.
Nice.
So, yeah, I didn't necessarily have that financial pressure to get out of that system, because I was getting paid. Getting paid to get advanced degrees is typically a pretty good investment. That was very good advice I got along the way.
Wow. That's really good advice.
Yeah,
because I mean, it can drag on for a long time.
Yeah.
But I thought the topic really interested me, and it was from a last year project that I did on rehabilitation for children who had gone a heart transplant and using aquatic therapy to help them. So it was like a really, really specific topic, and I was really interested in it. And But I also had lots of other interests, and one of them was in women's health. And actually, mm-hmm. when I was in Melbourne, I became pregnant while we were living there. I had used their medical system, and I had done a placement at the Royal Women's Hospital. So I got to see what their health system was like, and then I moved to the States, and I had all these ideas, and I found it really hard to get some traction with them, but I still had in mind of like, you know, I do want to work with moms. I want to help support women during that prenatal, postnatal period. Now I'm learning a lot more about the period that comes after that, the perimenopause, menopause. But I still had that in my mind. And then I moved back here, and I was waiting for my registration transfer, because it's a very long process. It took about over a year. Mm. And then I had met Emma Salmon, and she was getting this clinic up and running, and she had all the same ideas as what I had. And I went to work for her, and I've been there almost my third year now. And that's kind of the space that we've been trying to fill here, doing prenatal, postnatal physiotherapy care. And she works with patients as they go through cancer treatment as well. And there's a little bit of a tie-in too. I think that's one of the other things. Yeah, another thing that has made me feel at home here is that I had this in my mind of what I wanted to do, and now I'm doing it. And yeah, that makes me feel really happy and fulfilled here. Yeah.
Wow, amazing. Mm.
So, good thing I didn't go for that PhD.
I wouldn't be in New Zealand if I hadn't done my PhD, but
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very questionable decision in my path.
Yes, and it's always...
It worked out,
yeah.
But it's very indirectly related to my degree. Yes. Extremely indirectly, wow. Yeah.
And it's amazing for you guys, you know, to finish that, like for you, Brian, you know, to finish the PhD and do that. And, I mean, what you do here, Natalia, looks like a PhD already, right?
Yeah.
Oh, in PhD, continuously.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I've had a big milestone birthday, and I've just been thinking a lot about like, gosh, like how do you like? I just had this drive to go, and I never really thought about the risk. We moved across the world, and I did a postgrad program, and I'm like, what do you do to replicate that in your kids? You know?
Yeah.
And so I've been just thinking about a little bit more about like. What is that drive? Is that being an immigrant and you're just constantly looking for like that level, that heightened level of newness, or is it growing up where we grew up? Or
I recently read a piece that labeled, I don't know, sort of how I was raised and the environment that I grew up in and the people around me, labeled us as strivers. We just have this striver mentality to where there's kind of never enough. Like mm-hmm. It's part of the status. There's a status role of always working towards something more that I think was instilled in people in the States during a certain period. There, you know, there's a certain kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and create something in the States in general. And then I think, potentially, there's something generational also that just really kind of lights a fire under people mm-hmm. to get out and do as much as they can. And I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about raising children in New Zealand, where I would say that ambitious drive isn't necessarily as that flame isn't as intense as it is in the States. And kind of commented on, you know, mm-hmm. thinking about getting your kids to do, to go for more, I guess. What do you think about that?
I think that our problems and the things that we strive for are not necessarily theirs, and we have to respect them as human beings. it's a lesson that we have to learn, I think, that we can't fix everything for them. We can only, especially as they get older, we're only here as support and guidance.
Yeah.
We have to kind of wait for them to come to us. I've been really like, gosh, the lessons I've learned from being here, I feel like they really look at a kid as a whole, and they look at, well, how do they react to challenging situations? How can we help them? It's a lot more of a holistic approach. I don't know where it's going to take them in the future. And it's very different from, hey, set goals and be a leader and try to strive for the sky. Yes, it's very different. But gosh, I don't think I had the language and the wherewithal to be able to solve problems like I see the year fives and year six solve problems on the basketball court, and where they can say, hey, this is the reason you're overreacting. This is the feelings that are going on. Let's talk about it. Do you remember doing that as a kid?
No.
Sounds like
no, I don't remember.
They're instilling more emotional intelligence into kids these days.
Social awareness and knowing how to work with different people. And also knowing, it's really what impresses me is when someone makes a mistake, you support them.
Yeah.
And you kind of say, okay, like, you'll work through this and we'll be here with you. I see this also at the rugby club level with some of the younger players, and I see this in my kids' schools as well. I think it's a different approach, and I think there's benefits.
Yeah.
And there's no way I can, I'm not really, being an immigrant myself, I understand there's a little bit of, okay, you are going to pick what you want to pursue, there's going to be a little bit of a survivor mentality, and you can't necessarily kind of box your kid in and say, well, you're going to sit and do Russian math like I learned it, and you're going to read Russian classics, and we're going to have weekly lessons. I think that when they want to come to that, they can. So I'm a lot more laid back in the pushing the culture and language.
Yeah.
And I'm exposing them, but not making it part of a daily routine, which is very different from other immigrants.
I wanted to share an experience. Like, my daughter was playing basketball, and she's quite a gentle person, you know, so she doesn't fault or she doesn't try to pick the ball. And my husband, because he's from Germany, he afterwards tried to give her some feedback. And he said, combining the feedback here and feedback in Germany, who's quite straightforward. And he said, you did really well, and I think you should be more aggressive, you know. So what she understood from that she's not good enough, you know, because I think here kids are not used to that. So he had to know how to give her feedback, giving the situation, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's learning us as a parent how to combine our cultural background New Zealand background, which is quite hard.
I think also, but and then you hear that and you take the time to understand it and then change your approach. So we're not just going back the same way with the feedback for them. We're taking it in. Okay, this was too much. We can change the way that we give that feedback.
Yeah.
And we can change and respect their needs as well. My daughter's an interesting one because she kind of, I feel like, makes her own energy. Like I said, she's a really great self-advocate. She wants to be a part of everything. She's not very sensitive to feedback. And she's like, yeah, you take it or leave it. You can give me all the feedback you want, but she's going to want to do what she wants to do. Definitely. It's also the personality of the kid changes it too. And hey, sometimes we have really sensitive kids that
they don't get feedback, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you think, oh, this would have been fine for me as a kid, but you have to just change your approach. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I would say just back to the striver kind of mentality. And I think I grew up in a very outcomes-driven environment where whatever it takes, you to get the job done, you achieve. Like, it's very achievement-focused. And from what I've seen, it's not the most sustainable, fulfilling approach to doing things. How I view things between New Zealand and in the States, I think there's some happy medium between the two. It's definitely something I've thought a lot about, is that the ambition, the levels of ambition and drive between the two cultures, vastly, vastly different.
I think I actually think sometimes the work ethic here is even stronger than it is in the States, from my experience. Particularly with like areas of volunteering, you know, just seeing how many hours and how much work people put in as a volunteer, that it's like, it's just like a job. And I know that's not true for every industry and everybody, but I think, yeah, there's a lot of really, really hardworking people in Taranaki, and they just would never, ever tell you. You've got to see them at their work. There's so much humility that you're not going out advertising all your accomplishments. But yeah, I've definitely seen some.
Yeah, it's a big thing here with volunteering. So I agree. And because we have, I think, a few more minutes left, and I think we covered a lot today, and I was so impressive, you know, your story from Russia to the States and then Australia and New Zealand. I mean, you have such a big life experience, and your kids seem like very good kids. And we have our last question for today, which is mainly if you give like an advice to somebody who is new in town or new in New Plymouth or New Zealand, what would you tell them to do first?
I think be an observer. Observe what is going on in town first, and don't give up on living here too quickly. I think you have to give yourself more time than you think to feel like you are a part of this community, and you do have to keep putting in the work, raising your hand, saying yes to things. And even if it's not a similar culture from where you came from, I think my from all of my moves, I usually give myself 3 years to feel settled, but I think don't give up on living here. If this is really the place that calls you, I think take the time to find your niche and volunteer and say yes to things that you're asked for. And if you're like me and you're not likely to talk to someone in the grocery store and make friends, that's okay. This is still a place for you. I've heard some really great advice, I think, from you, Brian, of joining clubs and groups that you want to be a part of and then just continuing on with them. That's a great strategy. And taking your time to find also where you would like to be in Taranaki, in New Plymouth, whether that means moving between different neighborhoods or giving different parts of the town a go to live in. And even if you do like an activity and you trying out different clubs for it, if you can, like different soccer clubs. Just time makes things better. And learning, when I was moving here, I felt like I had so much information I could resource online about the cultural differences and what to expect, and doing that research and
So you're not getting as much of a culture shock when you do come over.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah.
And for people who want to find you somewhere, I don't know, maybe somebody's from Russia or Australia or the States and they want to talk with you.
Yeah, there's I try to attend some of the Russian speaking cultural group meetings.
Yeah.
So I would get in touch with Alona Williams to become a part of that. If anyone wants to go out and see a rugby game, this weekend we have the semifinals for Clifton, and you can find that information on Taranaki Community Rugby. I work at Physio Pilates, yeah, New Plymouth on Vivian Street, and that is owned by Emma Salmon, and you're really in good hands with anybody you see there. And what else do I do?
I don't know. Or we can see
now.
You at school, obviously, at Maryland, right?
Yeah.
Most of the days.
Oh, if anybody wants to join a very low pressure physical activity, I highly recommend Sunday Night Volleyball League. Mm. There is multiple tiers. It's a great one for moms who have been out of competitive sports for a long time. You are welcome to reach out to me. I'll put you on our team list. It's a lot of fun, low pressure, a lot of opportunity to improve, leave the house and just...
It's a great idea.
Yeah, just hit the ball around. There's no pressure and it's just so much fun. I highly recommend it. Usually the games are 6, 7, or 8 p.m. on Sunday nights, and it's addictive. I think this is my third year. Yeah, it's a really great activity.
Mm. Nice one. Maybe I will join.
Okay. And how do people find that?
Through Carla, who started Flourish. That's
Okay.
One.
We know Carla, so
yes.
Maybe you can send us a link, and then we can put it on your Facebook post. Yeah.
And Flourish is a great organization to get involved with. They do a lot of programming that's targeted towards families, and they're really like a community hub. Mm. So you can come in and on Tuesday, I'm part of the Te Mama series where you come in and you can bring your kids and you can pay someone to mind them or they can quietly sit in the corner. And every week they have a different specialist come in. So it might be a yoga day one day, somatic dance the next. It's all targeted towards moms.
Yeah.
There's some strength training. I do pelvic floor physiotherapy sessions, doing exercises targeting the pelvic floor. Some great resources and knowledge that can be gained from attending them. And
yeah,
very
it's
low
amazing.
Cost.
And
yes.
the sense of community, yeah, I second that. Yeah,
and
I,
the quality
I have also
of
been teaching there.
Oh, yeah.
On Tuesdays.
Cool.
So it's a really nice space for moms to get out of the house.
Yeah, and everyone that comes is just such a high quality presenter too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Even if your kids are grown, it's really great to use that and access it.
Yeah. And every Tuesday is something different. So, yeah, it's like from dancing to yoga to pelvic floor.
Yeah, and there's something for everyone, too. There's game nights for teenagers. There's sessions for parents to help with parenting. I know you've run some programs there.
Yeah. It's a great
place.
They
have a full schedule, yeah. And Flourish, they have a link on, they have a Facebook page. It's a great one. Mm.
And we also had Carla as a guest. So, I'm happy to promote that for Flourish. It's a great place to be.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Cool. And that will wrap up this week's episode of Making Yourself at Home. Thanks so much, Natalia, for being our special guest. And we're signing off. Alina, Clara, and Brian. From Access Radio Taranaki 104.4 FM, your voice, your choice. Have a beautiful and happy week out there, Taranaki, and have fun making yourself at home.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you next Monday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Natalia. Have a beautiful day.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information and others just like this, head along to our website, accessradiotaranaki.com.